Excellent. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the May 5th, 2025 Madison Landmarks Commission. Please remember, if you do plan to comment tonight, to fill out the green sheets that are over on the table and then hand them over here.
Or people can register off of their phones.
Oh, or you can register off your phones.
Just like you would a virtual meeting.
Is there anyone registered for agenda item number one, public comment? Okay, excellent. Then we will move on to disclosures and recusals. Members of the body should make any required disclosures or recusals under the city's ethics code. Seeing none, we will move on to agenda item number two. This is Legistar File 83865, Landmarks Commission Processes Training. Heather.
Okay.
Is there a meeting I'm supposed to be?
Nope. Nope. This is, well, in person, although I should be showing up. Well, let's see if we can. Home table laptop presentation source. No, you're supposed to be able to. This is no connection to this device. I can guarantee you I plug this in. Power, don't power off. Oh my gosh, technology.
Because I only do one of these a year.
Yes, because coming back into person is proven to be a challenge. Well, I mean, you can kind of see it, but that's less than ideal. All right, I'm going to continue on as if we can see it. Oh, that is terrible. I don't understand why it's shutting down. Okay, maybe if I continue on, it will. Not really. Okay. Well, I'll have stuff up on the screen. It would be handier if you could see it. Everything will end up being in the legislative file, so we can see it better after the fact. Okay. So one of the nice things about doing these in-person meetings is we can touch base and do some training. Really just, these aren't things that are going to be new to you, but I find, well, for myself, I do a lot of basics trainings at least annually, because for me, it's good to go back to the original material and make sure that I'm not drifting. So I thought we would touch base a little bit on parliamentary procedure and then do a little bit of refresher on the Secretary of the Interior standards, since those are the standards that we use less frequently. We more frequently are using our historic district standards. So I was updating the orientation materials for Alder Duncan and was reading through what was in there. And in reading through that, I was, one of the things that's in the packet is from the National Alliance of Preservation Commissions, and it's a short guide on parliamentary procedure. It's from 2009, so it's not ye old, but there are some language things in there that would be different if we were to write it now. But I thought it had some really good basics for parliamentary procedure. For some of our most challenging meetings, the best way to make sure that we can get through to a productive conclusion is to make sure that we have good process and we're doing good parliamentary procedure. So I thought this was a good refresher. So for the work that we do, we wanna make sure that we allow more motions that are in order. And so we have that a lot of our meetings where we make sure that we're clear on what exactly the motion is, and is there a, there's the person doing the motion, and do we have a second? And then we have a discussion. Make sure that people obtain the floor properly, that we don't just have folks unmuting and just taking over the discussion. And with that, I will say that is for all folks attending the meetings. I know with our system, alders have the privileges to come to any, what we say, BCC, board committee and commission meeting, and participate in the discussion. And so there is a lot of latitude given to alders, as there should be, but also there's still the rules for the meeting, and the alders have to abide by those rules as well. And sometimes that can be challenging. But in order for us to have a civil and orderly meeting, there's a set of rules for everybody. And so folks can't just unmute and take over a meeting. We need to have discussion that stays on topic. Yeah, but that can be uncomfortable. Speak clearly and concisely. That's not really a problem, I think, for our group, and obey the rules of debate. And we don't get into it much for our meetings. There are other BCCs where things get more acrimonious, but I really appreciate that this body, when we are having discussions, we're discussing about the project. We're not making personal comments. We're not commenting on, we're not taking pot shots at each other. We're not making snarky comments about the applicants or members of the public or anything. It is trying to keep this a civil and welcoming process, because this is supposed to be for the good of the people of Madison. And so we're wanting to make it welcoming and as pleasant as it can be. So I appreciate that. Thank you. I like this. There at the end, they say, most importantly, be courteous. And y'all are. Thank you. In the set of stuff, and this is in your orientation packet stuff, but I can also send it out to everybody again and probably go ahead and post it in the Legistar item since I'm talking about it at a meeting. It does have this matrix, which it would be awesome if y'all could actually see it on the screen. But talking about the different types of motions and can you interrupt the motion? Can you debate the motion? Can you amend it? And things like, to adjourn the meeting, no, that's not debatable. We're not going to have a debate about adjourning the meeting. I like, well, there's point of privilege is the way where it says to complain about room noise or room temperature or things like that. This has formal ways to go about making particular motions and how that works.
Is this in the packet that Lauren sent out? Where is that?
No, this was the orientation packet that we gave you when you started, back in the day. But I have made some updates to it for each person that comes on. I go through and take a look at it, but I made some more substantial updates to it recently. So I will send it out to everyone and post it up on the Legistar link so people see what it is we are sending to folks when they are training to serve on Landmarks Commission. But then there's a second matrix that has, again, more motions and sort of what goes with that. I'm not expecting folks to be experts on parliamentary procedure. Y'all seem pretty familiar with our process and how it goes. And when it comes down to a question, staff is supposed to be able to answer questions about parliamentary procedure. So if you have questions about something, feel free to ask, and you seem comfortable doing that. So yeah, it's just going through the having an orderly process. And with that, y'all can't see. It's Leslie Knope from the very first episode of Parks and Rec, which I love. And she says, what I hear when I'm being yelled at is people caring loudly at me. That these can be very emotionally charged situations. And the way to see us through that is to not take it personally and to not react personally. What I tell applicants is when they come in with a proposal, that I want to work with them to try to get to a yes, and also tell them that the Landmarks Commission wants to work with people to try to get to a yes, but that yes has to happen within our set of standards and our process. So it's not just, well, I want to do it because I want to do it. I hear the thing that you want to do, and here's the way we would have to go about it in order to make it happen. Now, having said that, there are situations where the only answer is going to be no. We don't have a lot of those. Usually we have one actual denial a year, but not all years. I can't think of a time where we had more than one. When we've had one that happened early in the year, I've been nervous about having multiples. But generally speaking, folks understand this is a process, that there's a set of rules, and we're trying to follow the rules so that they are fair and equitable to everyone. With our findings for motions, I'm trying to make sure in the staff report that I'm giving details so that this is a defensible motion. Since this is a quasi-judicial process, these are any actions that the Landmarks Commission takes for a certificate of appropriateness can be appealed to council, and then from there they can be appealed to court. So we're wanting to make sure we're making detailed findings in case it comes to that. So motion should cite compliance with this is the code or ordinance. And so for our standards, we say, you know, it's we find that it meets the standards of approval, and we have a discussion about what those standards are. If we're going to have an exception to a set of standards, then we need to talk about why that there's and be very specific in that. For if we're going to do something that is going to set a precedent, or why this is a unique situation and therefore it's not setting a precedent, if this is going to be a change in policy, and that is something that you can do to say, you know, we have decided that we're going to head in this direction and we think that this interpretation of the standards is the way that we're headed. Great. Then you need to say specifically why we're doing this, and then that is going to be the way we are doing our deliberations from here on out. And that comes down to the arbitrary and capricious. We don't want to be arbitrary and capricious. We don't want to say, well, I really like this project, therefore it's a yes. Or I think this looks nice, therefore it's a yes. We have to make our decisions based upon the standards of approval. Or I really like this person, or I think these people are good people, and therefore we will approve this project. We can't make our decisions based on, I've had folks say, well, you know that I wouldn't do something bad, and it's okay if I could, and I'm like, that's great, and we can have this personal relationship that way. But at the end of the day, I have to make it on the project and not on, I've got a good, you know, working relationship with you. It has to be based on the same set of standards for everybody. For one thing, while we might have a friendly relationship with this person, let's say somebody else moves in and now we've got a situation set up where it's going to create a conflict. We have to have something set up so that it is fair and equitable for everybody. We're not getting into arbitrary and capricious. Okay, talking about Secretary of the Interior standards, so when we're talking about the SOI, we just tend to shorten here for just talking about Secretary of the Interior standards. But for our purposes, we're doing the Secretary of the Interior standards related to rehabilitation. And for more academic preservation world, there's four treatment approaches. There's preservation, which means you're just keeping it the way that it is. Rehabilitation, so you're adapting it for new and ongoing uses. Restoration, which is where you are taking it back to a very specific point in time. Think Colonial Williamsburg or Greenfield Village. That's a restoration, taking things back to a very specific point in time. Or reconstruction, so let's say something's gone, and so you are recreating it. That's also a little Colonial Williamsburg. And it was an original treatment, and it's very less common now. So I have on the slide, not that y'all can see, a quote from a Park Service talking about that the rehabilitation standard has greater latitude and is used for replacing extensively deteriorated, damaged, or missing features, either using the same material or compatible substitute materials. But then also, yeah, says this is, if this is necessary for continuing or new use of the historic building. So it's really looking out. This isn't about museum pieces. This is about keeping this thing in operation and making sure it's a place that we can continue to use. So for rehabilitation, and I will read this at you in part because you can't see most of it. Rehabilitation is defined as the process of returning a property to a state of utility through repair or alteration, which makes possible an efficient contemporary use while preserving those portions and features of the property which are significant to its historic, architectural, and cultural values. And then I pulled out a thing from the Park Service that talks about, like, it gives a little bit of a background about using the standards, and it says that these standards have also been adopted by historic district and planning commissions across the country. Most historic preservation commissions, for all that these are federal standards, most historic preservation commissions use them. So the standards are to be applied to specific rehabilitation projects in a reasonable manner, taking into consideration economic and technical feasibility. And I think the composition of our Historic Preservation Commission is really key to how we go about that, because we're looking at, I was telling someone the other day that while I come up with design ideas that I think historically make sense, it's important that we have an architect on the Landmarks Commission, because while I might think this looks historically appropriate, it might not be technically feasible. And you need somebody with technical know-how to be able to say, yeah, thanks, that's nice, but here's how this would actually work. It's like, oh, okay, well, yes, great. Maybe we don't want that roof there shedding water onto a windowsill. Like, think of a project that we had something like that come in. But then that's also why we have a realtor on to talk about, well, we're doing this thing, but are we killing this property? And that's not what preservation is about. We want this to be a place that has utility, but is still able to convey its historic association, still able to tell the story of its significance, but also still be usable. I thought that I would go through the standards, but I was also envisioning that the screen would actually work. I'll just quickly read through. So, a property shall be used for its historic purpose or placed into a new use that requires minimal change to the defining characteristics of the building and its site and environment. This one we very rarely talk about because most folks are coming in with knowing if we're talking about adaptive reuse, it means they need to be using the existing building. When I was in Colorado, there was a building in Fort Collins. Fort Collins is big on microbreweries, so most of Colorado is. But there was a microbrewery that was moving into this Victorian house. In order to make the microbrewery work, they had to gut the entire building. And then they found they didn't have space for the other stuff. So they wanted to do all these dishes. And at the end of the day, there was really nothing left of the historic building. So it wasn't a use that was going to fit in that building. So that wouldn't meet that standard, where the amount of changes that they had to do, this wasn't going to be a good place to do it. But again, there's a lot of latitude, but then there's going too far. Historic number two is historic character of a property shall be retained and preserved. Removal of historic materials or alteration of features and spaces that characterize a property shall be avoided. If there's some key features where that is the thing that tells the story of this property, maybe we shouldn't be taking those things off, which is part of why things for additions and alterations, we're looking at maybe the size, particularly, significantly step back or on the rear, because that's not typically the place where you have the significant feature, be it architecturally or historically. Each property shall be recognized as a physical record of its time, place, and use. Changes that create a false sense of historical development, such as adding conjectural features or architectural elements from other buildings, shall not be undertaken. And this standard usually doesn't come into play at Landmarks Commission, but as staff working with applicants, it comes up a lot for folks who say, well, I saw this thing on some other property, or I was traveling to this other place and they had this thing and I want it on my building. Okay, well, if it is, particularly if it's something very ornate, the answer is probably going to be no. Did your building historically have this feature that you're now wanting to make a key feature of the building? It didn't. Okay, well, then, and this is something we never had here. When I was in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, there was Colonial Revival building on Main Street, and somebody had just come back from New Orleans and saw a lot of ornate stuff, and they wanted to have some ornate wrought iron on their front porch. And they're like, but this is historic. Well, yes, it's historic for a particular building from a particular place and time that your building isn't. And so that would be a conjectural detail and a false sense of historical development. So, no. But that also gets into things like, let's say we have plans that show like an addition or a tower or something like that that was never constructed. And then we want to come back then and add this feature that would make it look like a totally different building. That's adding in a conjectural detail. Most properties change over time. Those changes that have acquired historic significance in their own right shall be retained and preserved. And that comes down in part to a choice and making a case for something like restoration, where you're taking it back to a period in time. You're taking off some of those features that you just make the argument for. This is the point in time that we think is the most historic. We don't have this come up a lot with our properties, but it could be a point of discussion. Standard five, distinctive features, finishes, and construction techniques or examples of craftsmanship that characterize a property shall be preserved. Generally speaking, folks are trying to fix up the features on the building, and they're not just wholesale taking stuff off just because. And I think with that, well, when we get into number six, deteriorated historic features shall be repaired rather than replaced. The severity of deterioration requires replacement of a distinctive feature. The new feature shall match the old in design, color, texture, and other visual qualities. We don't want to have scope creep of, well, if we're taking it off, then oh my gosh, let's do this thing. It'll be fancier and prettier. And nope, let's recreate what was there. And where possible with materials, replacement of missing features shall be substantiated by documentary, physical, or pictorial evidence. So if your house doesn't have a porch anymore, and we have information that shows that there used to be a porch, then we can talk about reintroducing a porch. If your building never had a porch, then that goes into the false conjectural details. But for most folks, they understand that they've got a historic property. And yes, there's places where we need to do some repairs, but we're not wholesale stripping everything off and putting on new materials. The point of these buildings is that they are real historic places. And that means actual historic materials. but we want them to be in good repair. They don't need to look shiny and new. They're not new builds. We also don't tend to see these two standards very much. The chemical or physical treatments, such as sandblasting that can cause damage to historic materials, shall not be used. I encourage you, if you're downtown, to go to the Great Dane, the downtown Great Dane, and the building that's the sort of main restaurant portion, not the side with the billiards and all, to feel that building. It was an early preservation project, and I've seen the minutes from the meetings in the 70s where they had refreshed the building, and part of that they had sandblasted the building to take off the years of grime. And the minutes from Landmarks Commission, and they were gushing about, you know, how nice it looked and how great it was. But that took off the, we learned, we learned with historic preservation, we thought that was an appropriate treatment. And we learned that, no, that wasn't so good. And so anytime I go to the Great Dane, I pet the building. I pet a lot of buildings, though. I pet the building because it is coming apart and is deteriorating. And like, particularly if you go up to the edges, the lines are wavy on the brick because it, the protective coating on the ends of the brick is gone. It was removed in the 70s. And so that is a good example of, we thought that that was good preservation and we've learned more now. And that building has had some, yeah, damage from the preservation efforts of 50 years ago. The two standards that we primarily deal with are the two standards that most historic preservation commissions deal with, and that's standards 9 and 10. New additions, exterior alterations, or related new construction shall not destroy historic materials that characterize the property. The new work shall be differentiated from the old and shall be compatible with the massing, size, scale, and architectural features to protect the historic integrity of the property and its environment. So that is really our biggest standard that comes into play with, if we do this new thing, is it totally changing the history of this property, or is it going to be compatible? Is it going to fit? And with the standard 10, new additions and adjacent or related new construction shall be undertaken in such a manner that if removed in the future, the essential form and integrity of the historic property and its environment would be unimpaired. If we were to take this thing off, is the historic property going to be able to continue to be okay? So, yeah. I was going to use this slide as a transition to talking about the ordinance stuff in a bit. So I will just stop sharing and we can move on to the next agenda item.
Thank you, Heather. Does anyone have any questions for Heather?
Yes.
You likely don't have an answer, but I am curious, since these are federal standards, if you expect there to be any changes with the current administration. Will any of our work be affected by that?
Maybe. For federal stuff, like, will there be changes? Yes. There already are. There's quite a few executive orders that are gutting the federal compliance processes. And with that, with the way these are being streamlined, it takes out the involvement of stakeholders and state historic preservation offices. And so stakeholders would be us. So we are a formal consulting party for work that has a federal nexus that could impact historic properties within the jurisdiction of Madison. And with the streamlining of stuff, it is supposed to be just handled internally, and the federal agency decides if they think they should do compliance or not, and there aren't really checks and balances. So we will likely be excluded from being a consulting party and being a part of the discussion for some projects that have a federal nexus at the moment. For other stuff, while these are federal standards and we are using them, if let's say they go away, we can still use them. We might talk about changing some language in our ordinance for using them, because there's a great deal of case law for local governments to use these standards. So we'll probably discuss with our lawyers what that means if it comes to that. For other stuff, we received the notification that our certified local government grant to do the historic context for public and civic, was it civic and commercial architecture from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that we were awarded that grant, but also not to do anything because the federal funds for that had not been encumbered yet and might not be. So yay, we got an approval. Our grant application was successful. Boo, we can't do anything with it. And we don't know if we will ever be able to do anything with it. So that will have an impact on the amount of survey that we're able to do, because that was the funding for most surveys. So if we're doing surveys, it either has to be staff does it or the city has to fund it. Yeah. On that happy note.
I do also think there was, at some point, the Park Service was looking at their standards again. I think they ultimately decided not to make any changes, but there were a bunch of...
There were a lot of... I commented emails, several times.
Yeah, email sent, comments. I definitely filled out at least one survey. So, but I think they ultimately decided not to make any changes.
Yep.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, we can move on to agenda item number 3. This is Legistar File 83866, the 5-year check-in on City of Madison Historic Preservation Plan.
Okay.
Is there any way to get it to, right, like, to make it just like power off and then come back?
Yeah. See what happens, but I also don't want to stop.
Yeah.
Tell you what, let's do a, if someone moved to do a like 2-minute recess, then we can pause the recording, fiddle with the technology.
I moved to take a 5-minute recess to work on the technology.
Second for Maurice.
Thank you. Then we'll have a 5-minute recess. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, we are back with technology still not playing nicely. I will go ahead. Everyone should have the internal Zoom link to be able to see the things that I share. For the folks in the audience, I will still put it up on the screen, and I'm sorry you won't be able to see it very well since our technology is not playing nicely with us.
I think if you do choose to join the Zoom, make sure that you've turned your audio off.
Oh, yes, please. Thank you.
Been in many a meeting where
I was gonna say, it seems like you've done this before. Okay, so got this here. I was going to talk through the staff memo for the preservation plan. Let me go ahead and just share this up on the screen.
Is it there?
Nope, that's what I want. Okay, so there are many strategies and priorities in the preservation plan. In order to try and make that more user-friendly, we ended up pulling out some priority strategies. And so that's what I included in the staff report, with going through the ones that we decided were the biggest priorities. Also in the preservation plan Well, we talked about the things that we wanted for preservation in the city. They weren't always things that the city would be the lead on. Some of them were going to be happening with community partners. So for the ones that we have, the first one was place plaques at existing buildings and places, lost buildings, and cultural sites to identify significant historical events and locations. Okay, well, and then that kind of goes into number two, develop tourism marketing and branding materials that highlight historic attractions in the city. We approved last year our historic markers program. I'm supposed to be getting back to you with a formalized process, and we're doing tribal consultation for a couple of the signs, but we will be installing those this year. And so that is something that, you know, here at the 5-year mark, we're actually getting underway. But for the developed tourism marketing materials that highlight historic attractions at the city, our historic markers program will assist with that, but also our previous surveys, like the underrepresented community survey and our old cultural walking tours, we added those to our website. And so all of those materials are out there for people to use. They are public information. And so like the Madison Trust uses that material for helping to develop their walking tours. There's a commercial operation that is supposed to be doing tours that's also using that information. It is out there for people to have and use. And so I'm not going around inventorying the folks that are using the historic materials for tourism marketing and branding, but I am directing people to that information so that people can make use of it. Coordinate an urban design program to visually promote city-owned historic buildings and places. So that was generally a city item. This is partially addressed the engineering division, which one of the folks who works for the engineering division is Amy Scanlon, the former preservation planner. That might be part of why this is there. But on their page, they have a historic preservation page that talks about the city-owned historic buildings and the work that we do for preserving those buildings. And they also tend to do some little information pieces during Preservation Month, which is this month, to promote the preservation work that the city is doing with the historic buildings that we own. And so I appreciate that they do that for highlighting. Otherwise, in terms of the like an urban design program that visually promotes city-owned historic buildings, I think the physical work that engineering does with these buildings is probably the best place for that. Otherwise, Parks also owns several historic properties, and their individual pages talking about the particular historic parks that they have do talk about that they are historic and why they are significant. Determine which types of buildings and places are underrepresented in the current historic resources inventory. And so we've been having discussions about that. And so our last in-person meeting, we talked about what would be our priorities for different topics. And then we submitted a survey grant and we won it. And now we might not do that. So we are also working on addressing this as part of our area plans. And I think I get into that more detail further down, but we have one of the things in the preservation plan also identified a survey plan for to make sure we are doing some type of historic resources survey that covers the entire city over a 10-year span. And shortly after we did the preservation plan, we then came up with this area plan framework where we were going to be doing area plans to make sure that we covered the entire city. And rather than continuing with the schedule of which parts of the city we had in the preservation plan, we said, well, let's work with the area plans and make sure we were doing covering those. So I do a very high level inventory of here's the historical properties that we know about, and these are the ones that might be of historic interest, and also talking through the benefits of preservation. Here's what you could get if you do state and national register. Here's what you get if you do local landmark. Also talking about archaeology, for we have many, many human burial sites in the city that are historic. There are tax benefits for if you have a property that has a human burial on it, because that is then considered an undevelopable portion of your property. And so there are tax benefits with that. And we actually had a property in the last year or so go through that process. And so I worked with the city assessor's office to get that documented so that we are no longer taxing that portion of the property that is a human burial site. You can get a tax break for that. I am happy to send that information to you. Yeah. There is a process for if you have a human burial site on your property that is considered undevelopable, and they have to make it a cataloged burial.
That was my next question.
Did it have to be that needed to do the garage?
We're going to be,
site.
Yep.
You're going to make
a, we are about to see that project again. Because they are coming
from the garage.
Yep. Oh, is this a,
that was from a couple of years. That was from,
was that 2 years ago? Or the last,
more than that? It was a while ago.
But there's, or maybe it's a different property, but we're going to be looking at another garage related to an archaeological site, here in an upcoming meeting. But, yes, there are some tax benefits to having a human burial site on your property. Develop a top 10 historic buildings and places to preserve, exhibit, or program. And I ended up not writing anything underneath that. I don't see how I am ever going to have the bandwidth to do that. In terms of places that are priorities, I have a discussion with, when Bob Kleba calls me up and says, are there some buildings that you think are a priority that we should look on doing a designation on? I tell him. but a top 10 historic buildings and places to preserve. I have seen those endangered places programs be very successful. I've also seen them be pretty hostile. I don't know. I think that might be something for a community partner, but I don't know that it is a wise move.
So that's intended to be places that are not already like
designated,
marked in some way as historic or, yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Develop a database of properties that are eligible for historic tax credits. So we kind of started this on the main landing page for our historic preservation program. There is a map that has different colors of things on it, and that some of them are to show National Register districts, some are to show local districts, but it doesn't have any labels to tell you what the different colors of things are. It's not searchable. So it's pretty, but it's not particularly useful. And the person who was working on it isn't anymore. So something like that, I have an ask in for that, for the work on that to continue to happen so that it is searchable and usable. So then folks, if you have a property that is listed in the state and or National Register of Historic Places, there's the possibility for preservation tax credits for you to do work on your property and get some money for doing that work. But folks don't always know that. And while you can look that up on the state's website, you kind of have to know what you're doing. If we are providing information about historic properties in Madison, it is something that we can do. I don't have the GIS technical savvy to make it happen, and we're kind of down a person in GIS internally within planning division. So when we get the staff power to make that happen, then we will have that available. Encourage adaptive reuse as an affordable housing option. I think that is challenging with the development pressures in Madison. All property is really unaffordable right now. But talking about reusing existing buildings was something that was addressed in the 2019 Equitable Development Study. And I do have a link to that in the staff report if you haven't read through it. It is, I think, a worthwhile read. Develop a document that outlines the development proposal review process and criteria for historic properties, educate staff, departments, committees, and the public. So we've done some of this, but not all of this. Some of this information we cover in the area plans. I have developed a training about archaeological compliance for city departments, because while we do the planning stuff, the agencies that actually deal with land and dig things up needed a refresher on that compliance training. So I do that internally. And so that is partly a development process when the city is doing things, we're making sure that we're complying with state burial law. But I think this strategy is really talking about having a one pager that talks about the intricacies of the application process and development process. And we don't have that. We should. So it's on my radar as something that it would be really nice for us to be able to get to. Prepare illustrated design guidelines. We did that. And I've got a link to that. Yay. And it's been super helpful. Both Mary Rose and I direct people to it. Say if you've got questions, you know, this might be helpful. And folks are finding it helpful. They're telling us, oh yeah, that actually ended up being really helpful. The folks who aren't finding it helpful are finding that that means that they can't do the thing that they hope that they can do. But it does show them ways that they could go about it. But yay on that. That was ended up being harder to get off the ground than we thought it would. Consider properties with existing National Register designation, and those identified through survey work for local designation. I'm addressing those in the area plan stuff, putting that information out there. And then we are getting some inquiries from folks who have questions about, you know, what does it mean for this type of designation? What about this type of designation? I haven't had a property owner fully take anything through yet, but we're starting to have those discussions. And I think discussions is a good place to start. Utilize a variety of tools, both digital and in person, to gather and post information about Madison's history, diversity, and culture. So I did talk about we created an entirely new page that has the cultural walking tours. We were having people would call because they would hear about them. And we had some copies still in our office, and then we would mail them or people would come by and pick them up. But then I think it was Lauren who said, you know, we scanned all these a while ago. And I was like, we did. Why don't we have them up on our website? So they're up on our website and people can use them, and they do use them. And that is fantastic. But in terms of other folks getting information out there, we also have a public information officer now. And so we're able to pass along information and get that out, I think, better. But work on this, I would say, is ongoing. Reach out to local underrepresented groups to gather additional information about buildings, places, and events that would be part of Madison's story. So I say this work is happening under ongoing survey work. Work is ongoing with this item, but this is not something that I think we'll be able to, particularly for underrepresented communities. I don't see us being able to get federal grant funds for that for the foreseeable. Even for our architecture context, I had phrased the grant application, because that stuff went in September, as these were resources that were underrepresented in our inventory. And I asked the State Historic Preservation Office, when you report to the Park Service that we've been awarded this grant, can you take the word underrepresented out? Because that is one of the words that is being, while it is technically true, it is one of the ones that is being word searched. And this is an architectural, for all that I really wanted to do the disability rights historic context, I think that would not have made it through federal funding. And the architecture one might not either. But yeah, if we're going to do more stuff with underrepresented communities, that is something the city's going to have to foot the bill on, which we will. Utilize social media to announce events and engage the public on historic preservation practices, events, policies, and projects. We do have some information out there. I have added some stuff up on our website about, Mary Rose and I have been doing lots of things with the website. Mary Rose has been doing a lot of work to do a plain language review to get our the language that you don't need to have a specialized training in historic preservation to understand what the words say. Let's make it so that's accessible for anybody. But we've included some links and some how-tos. There's a how-to video. I don't know how helpful that is for helping people navigate through the application process for landmark stuff. But that's just landmarks focused, not dealing with a larger thing. But we do have some things out there. I will say, I think this is something that is ongoing. Create interactive websites, online articles, exhibits, and tours on the benefits of preservation. I would go back to there's information on our website, there's information in the area plans. I do lots of conference presentations and webinars to talk about the things that we do with Madison. But I think there's always more work to do on that. But as I've just talked at y'all about the things that are there, what are some things that you see as preservation priorities for us to be thinking about for the next 5 years before we do a new preservation plan. Other than somebody having a magic wand to make money fall out of the sky.
Righto.
Cool. And curious, are there ways that this body can support any of this work?
You know, with smaller historic preservation commissions, it tends to be very volunteer. And so the commission is doing lots of like the public education and outreach stuff. But we're not a small town. Well, I don't know, in some ways we are. I've got so many stories about Madison really being a small town. Our work tends to be more formal because we're larger and we've got these larger development proposals coming through. So are there things that you can be doing? Not necessarily. I would say as you are thinking about things or you come across stuff in the community and you've got questions about something or you think there's something that we should maybe check out, please feel free to reach out. And if you want to be that you sent something to me and you want me to investigate it, cool. If it's something that you want to have a larger discussion with the commission, you can always send something in for it to be included as a discussion item on the agenda and we can talk about it. If it's something that you think the commission should talk about, we can talk about it. Cool. All right.
Anything else for Heather on agenda item number 3? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to agenda item number 4. This is Legistar file 88167. Lauren, do we have registrants for this online?
There's one person registered, Alex Saludos, neither in support nor in opposition, wishing to speak, but he is not present. So okay. He submitted written comments and they're posted in Legistar.
Yes, and they are in our email also. Before I hand it over to you, Heather, I'm going to take the time to ask if anybody here is planning to register to speak for this item. And if you are, please fill out a green slip and or please register online. And I'm going to hand it over to Heather.
Okay, so we have had our historic district portion of the ordinance in place since 2022. And we've been able to see it in process. For the slide that I wanted to have up, I've got to go back to share. Probably you can't really see with it. So one of the things with the historic district ordinance was that we got really specific in the alterations section, and that largely aligned with the stuff that was showing up in the policy manual for the things that staff could administratively approve. But a lot of the alterations were still falling into some gray areas, and so they were coming to the commission for review. But by making the alteration section much more specific, a larger chunk of the projects that are coming in are being administratively reviewed and approved. And then we are just using the commission's time for the big thing. So we're talking about additions, demolitions, new construction. On occasion, there are some alterations that seem significant enough that we want your take on it rather than us doing administrative approvals. So like, the next meeting that we have in May, there's going to be a request from the city, from the engineering division, for installing 2 flagpoles out in front of this building in a non-historic planters out front. So maybe when you walk outside, take a look at the planters on either side of the steps. but that would be a change on the front of the building. And while it's technically underneath the alterations, well, this is Secretary of the Interior standards, but falling into that sort of alterations that this is changing the front of a significant building, and we want your input before staff is just like, yeah, this seems all right. So with that, though, are the number of items that are coming on the agenda at Landmarks Commission are dwindling while the number of administrative approvals continue to be pretty high. We're still putting out more certificates of appropriateness than we have ever. No.
Okay.
No, just letting y'all know, particularly for those of you who have been on for a while, that, you know, our agendas that tend to be shorter. And so I'm looking at the percentages. What the highest of the last few years was in 2018, 31% of the total projects that came in went to the Landmarks Commission. Whereas for the last 2 years, in 2023, 12% went to Landmarks Commission, the rest were administrative. And last year, 10% went into the Landmarks Commission and the rest were administrative approvals. And they're all just, they are following the standards that we reviewed. But in doing the application of standards and getting into, stop sharing this and get over to the red line version, getting into the, trying to do two things at once. Draft text amendment. Actual language, there are a few places that I think in the historic district standards could use some tweaks. But also there are some language things that I think could use some adjustment. Last year, one of the documents we looked at was the messaging guide for local historic preservation programs from the National Alliance of Preservation Commissions. And in one of their discussion things, they talked about changing the language from certificate of appropriateness to certificate of approval. And when I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, that makes a lot of sense. Certificate of appropriateness comes across as very snobby and very exclusionary. And then people see it as the overly precious and So I get a lot of feedback on that. But this is really about the approval from the Landmarks Commission. We can still use the same, I can still say COA. And so I wouldn't have to change this there. But if we change it from certificate of appropriateness to certificate of approval, this is just the approval from the Landmarks Commission. Why don't we issue COAs that are called certificate of approval instead of certificate of appropriateness? It's a simple word change, but it would also involve changing that word, not just in the historic preservation ordinance, but it shows up in several other places. So in the draft that I sent you, the
you have to change it throughout the whole text.
Yep. Be a find and replace. Yeah, it's a lot. The city attorney's office has said okay that they will take it on for the stuff. But there are a couple of other things that I highlight in terms of like some overall stuff. The threshold of what needs a public hearing is right now it's at 100 feet. If you're doing an addition or a like garden shed that is more than 100 square feet, then it needs a public hearing. And when we put in, we didn't always have the specificity of exactly the square footage. And when we put it in, we use the 100 square feet because at that point in time, that was the threshold for what type of structure needed a building permit. If it was at least 100 square feet, then yes, you need a building permit. But that's not the threshold anymore. Building permits, it's 150 square feet. So it's not a whole lot more, but now we are out of alignment. And looking at the types of garden sheds coming in, I know we've had several that have come in where we're looking at stuff and you know they're like 120 square feet. Well, while the policy manual says that staff can approve small things like garden sheds administratively, our ordinance says if it is more than 100 square feet, it has to have a public hearing. We have to send out postcards. Somebody wants to do a garden shed that's 120 square feet. I think that we could handle 120 square foot garden shed. So I was going to recommend that we align the language to put it back into being alignment with our building permits and put it at 150 square feet for that's the stuff that triggers needing to put out a postcard. Sorry, let me get back over to the staff report for other things. If we were doing some language changes, I also wanted to get into indigenous materials and craftsmanship. So the way
you aren't sharing.
Oh, sorry.
It's a heads up.
Yeah, details.
Can you go down a little bit? Because
yeah.
Behind
the show. Let me share in the Zoom. Technology, that's so much fun. Okay. Indigenous materials and craftsmanship was language that is from the original portion. Sorry. Maurice, can you see it now?
Is there
there, okay, was original language in the historic preservation ordinance. And what we meant was locally sourced materials like Madison sandstone, but we talked about it as indigenous materials. And generally speaking, with word usage now, if we're talking about indigenous, we mean native peoples. And so that's, it ends up resulting in more descriptive to try to differentiate what we're talking about. So I'm recommending that we take out the thing about indigenous materials. And so one of the things I put in there is a historic sandstone house is constructed with local materials, likely by a local craftsperson. Historic mounds are constructed by indigenous, constructed of indigenous materials by indigenous craftspeople, that those are different things. We have stuff that are indigenous materials designed and constructed by indigenous people, but we have a lot of like Madison sandstone buildings that are noted for their indigenous materials. Why don't we just call that, it's about vernacular architecture and we're using, you know, local crafts, crafting materials and local craftspeople. Let's just use local. I also talk about, we have this whole thing to define what a master is, and master has a lot of different connotations and challenges. And the definition is about, you know, somebody who has a, you know, noted career and, you know, has made impacts in their field, that I think maybe it's time for us to let go of the term master. And so in the descriptions where it talks about essentially where that, where this is significant because it is the work of a master, why would you say it's the work of an architect or a designer of note, and have that in the language and just remove the definition of master and drop the term master from our ordinance.
Replace it with of note.
And essentially, yes, you replace it with of note. That's in the description. So in the red line version that's attached to the agenda, you'll see the places where that is. I want to say, we're not talking about making any changes tonight. This ordinance has not been introduced. I wanted you to give you a, this is a working draft, get some feedback before staff works with an alder to get this introduced. If and when this gets introduced, it would be introduced at council, and then it would be immediately referred to Landmarks Commission, where you would do your formal review and do feedback, and then it would be, you would then refer it to Common Council to take action. Computation of time is something that has made us crazy. So with LORC 1, Landmarks Ordinance Review Committee, the first time around, sorry, let me get this back down here, there were computation of time. As part of the public process, the feedback from the public was that they wanted more time, that the 10-day public notice wasn't enough time, and they wanted more time. So what they added in, well, in the portion of the ordinance where it talks about doing public hearings, it says that you do a 10-day public noticing, but then you, there's no cross-reference to it. You have to know that you go up to this other section at the beginning of the ordinance that talks about special provisions. And there's a section called computation of time that talks about that you don't count weekends and holidays for any time thresholds that are under 14 days. Well, they're all under 14 in the ordinance. They're pretty much all say 10. So why do we have, and to me, it's like, you know, one eye jacks and, you know, red twos are wild. This seems, it's not accessible. It seems like we're hiding this provision. But also in terms of like when's there are holidays, there are sometimes where, you know, oh, there's a holiday, so we have to add a day in. There's a day where there's a holiday, but it's also a city observed holiday, like Thanksgiving is a holiday, but then the city observes Ho-Chunk Day on Friday. So then it's two additional days for stuff around those December meetings, sending stuff out. So we have introduced more uncertainty in terms of when the public notification needs to go out. And it's been clunky and it's caused problems. So if we really mean more time, while Plan Commission and Urban Design Commission and the Zoning Board of Adjustment or Appeals, while they all do 10 days and they just mean 10 days, if what we really mean is more time, why don't we just say 14 days instead of sometime this and sometimes these other things and get rid of, so in the redlining, I'm changing computation of time to just talk about calendar days. And while all the other ones do 10 days. Travis to change all the things that say 10 days and change it to 14. And then it's 14 days and it's just 14 days without you having to go find the special secret language at the beginning of the ordinance that tells you that those days, some days count, some days don't. All days would just count and it would be 14 days. If anybody has feelings on that. and I already talked about the accessory structures, sizes of additions going from 100 to 150. And then in the historic district standards, there are a couple of places where I wanted to add in some clarifications. There's some sections where it talks about windows and doors, but in some of the standards, it just talks about windows. And that's from back when we had originally had separate standards for doors and windows, and then we ended up combining them all together. And in some places we didn't add door in, and there's at least one place where I was like, wait, we need to have the word door here. Cause right now it just says windows and we mean windows and doors instead of saying, well, this is what we really meant. It should just say that. But there's also a couple of tweaks on stuff about some alterations possibly being okay further back on the sides. Because right now it talks about that changes can't, well, like if we're infilling some door and window openings or introducing more door and window openings, it can't be on any areas that are visible from the developed public right-of-way. But if somebody's doing an addition on the side of the building, we would want it significantly step back from the front. So why can somebody do an addition, but they can't do a door? Mm-hmm. That to me just seemed nonsensical. If you pay more and build a single story, yes. If you just want to do a door, no, that doesn't make any sense to me. So there's some language in there. We have some language about, I think it's about dormers and about skylights. It's a stepped back. I can't remember if it's 12 feet or 14 feet. It's in there. But I use that same language for, instead of just saying significantly step back from the front, then you get into, well, how far? When I was in Durango, somebody, this language was significantly step back from the front, and I had an applicant come in and it was 1 foot back. And I was like, that's not significant. Well, how much is? Well, I have to react to your proposal. And I'm going to tell you your proposal of 1 foot is not enough. Rather than duking that out, why don't we just specify, just be consistent with our standards. And we mean 14 feet, step back. If somebody wants to come in with something different, they can come in and make a variance request and make an argument for something. But yeah, wanting to make sure that for our alterations, that they align with the same things we would want for additions, that they could be on the sides if they're significantly set back and still meet the character. So I'm going to encourage you, I'm not expect, if you have feedback now, happy to take feedback. Really, I was wanting to introduce this to you, give you time to read through it because ordinance reading is mind-numbing. But give you time for, there's my staff cover memo that covers through the themes. There's a red line version attached to that agenda item. Please read through it and look for the things. If there are other things that as we've been doing projects that you think we should go back and look at again, if we're going to open up the ordinance and look at some things, let's go ahead and just do it now. And we'll go through a text amendment process. So if you have any feedback today, otherwise we'll see this at some point in the future, assuming that legislation gets introduced and then referred.
Anyone have any questions for Heather? You answered all of mine. I was like, oh, or I don't, it feels a little abrupt to be voting on this right now. So
I have one comment, which is super tiny, but certificate of appropriateness is sometimes capitalized and sometimes isn't throughout the document.
So our the city attorney's office also caught that. And they said, if it's a proper noun, shouldn't they all be capitalized? And I said, I would agree. I just changed it to change the words in the places where they were and went with the capitalization, not capitalization that was there. But yes, if you want to change them all, I'm on board with changing them all. So yes.
And then I guess I have a question just because this was in the comment that was submitted about, and it was something I wondered too, when I saw master and maybe this is, might be a question for Jacob too. Like, is it a term? Like, I think there are fields where master is like, there's a clear It's not subjective. It's like, yep, you earned this by doing this coursework or earning,
right,
a certificate.
Like you're an electrician. There's, yes, you know, there's a journeyman electrician, there's a master electrician.
But is for, it seems like for architect, that is not the case, that, yep, this is just a word people have chosen to use.
It's completely, okay, subjective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So then of note to me, I'm totally fine with that change.
And for internal stuff and sort of like architecture world, the being a master and being part of a group tended to be, well, used for sort of exclusionary purposes, for this is the good old boys club and we're the real ones, and you folks, you guys are outsiders, and you know, you're not real masters of your craft and you're doing weird things and that's silly. If we take that very subjective thing out, this isn't for, if we had a professional reference thing for us to go by, but we're really talking about people who are noted in their field, and it could be architect, it could be a builder, but somebody who has made an impact and they are significant for what they did. Yeah.
Anything else? All right. Okay. Checking with Lauren one more time to just make sure no one has.
Refresh. No additional register.
Okay, excellent. Anything else tonight? Otherwise, I will be looking for a motion to adjourn.
I'll move to adjourn.
I'll second.
Thank you, everyone, for coming, and nice seeing you all in person for at least one time a year.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.